Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Last Post Radio Show podcast series. That's a mouthful for you, particularly on a Monday morning. We have a special guest. As always, we speak to some wonderful people, and none more so than Margaret Anderson, director of the Old Treasury Building Museum in, I think it's 20 Spring Street, isn't it, Margaret?
It is 20 Spring Street, East Melbourne, if you want to be absolutely correct.
Well, let's get that right. Let's not muck about with that. So it's East Melbourne. It's a beautiful place. You've had, of course, the magazine, the Last Post magazine, has been in partnership with the Old Treasury Building now for a number of years. And, of course, Katie and you and the team have been wonderful for the people of Melbourne and Australia with your exhibitions. You've got a whole lot on there at the moment. Tell us about a couple of those. We can go through them all, but what are the outstanding ones there for you, Margaret?
Oh, thanks, Greg. Well, probably the exhibition that is of most interest to some of your viewers just at the moment is a show that we've had on for some years, but we'll be finishing quite soon. And that's an exhibition about the various things that women did contributing to the war effort during World War II. And we called it Women Work for Victory in World War II.
Yes.
It was an exhibition that we did actually during COVID. It was an odd one, Greg, because, of course, we're all in the middle in Melbourne, as you probably know, of the longest COVID lockdown. I think it was in the world, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It tested the mettle of a few people, Margaret.
It certainly did. And at the museum, we were closed for months and months. And we were, of course, closed when the exhibition was due to open in August. And so what we did was, because we had the exhibition ready to go, we didn't have all of the loans in for obvious reasons, but we had all the rest of the content ready to go. So we actually opened that exhibition in inverted commas online, if you like. And for the first time, we put up a little, what we called a flip book, which was a little booklet that was created with all the content in it. So that people could see what would be in the exhibition when we finally managed to open it, which we did later in the next year. But it was a great exhibition. And the reason why we decided to do that was because when we looked through the list of what was being done elsewhere, we realised that there was very little that was reflecting on the role that women had during the war. And of course, there were some very interesting innovations that happened for women in particular in the workforce and generally during World War II.
It was an interesting time, Margaret, because in many ways, I think this is a social observation, but in many ways, the war actually brought forward a lot of independence for women. And I guess through working during the period of the Second World War, a lot of women weren't terribly flushed with the idea of actually giving that independence back.
Well, no, they weren't, but they were pretty much forced to. As you probably know, John Curtin struck a deal at the start, well, in the beginning of the war, because they worked out very early that they needed women's labour, particularly in the factories, munitions factories and various other places, which had been almost exclusively staffed by men before the war. They were also called men's jobs. Now, you probably know that at that time, the workplace was pretty much divided into women's jobs and men's jobs. Mm. And women's jobs attracted around about a bit over half the wages that men were paid. So there was at this time no minimum wage for women. There was for men, but not for women. So Curtin struck a deal because it was a move to recruit women was opposed by both the trade union movement and employers. Trade union movement was afraid of competition from women workers who were paid less. And employers were afraid that if women were actually paid more during the war, they'd go on to want more after the war, and the that would flow on to so-called women's jobs. So they were rarely in accord, the unions and the employers were in accord. So Curtin very craftily struck a deal, which was that women would be recruited and paid more. He didn't ever commit to equal pay. And it was never really achieved during the war, despite there were a couple of anomalies, but generally it wasn't. But they would be employed for the duration of the war only, and that they would give up their jobs when the men came home. And that was exactly what happened. And so, I mean, the interesting thing was that women did get opportunities for those who wanted them to work in areas like munitions, aircraft manufacture, all of these sorts of jobs that everybody thought women couldn't do. And they were paid more than they had been. The rates varied between about 70% and 90%. The only people interestingly, the only people who were paid equally during the war were people like medical officers, so doctors. And some very small groups were actually had equal pay during the war, but they were very much an anomaly. At the end of the war, what happened? I mean, of course, all of those munitions industries and things were scaled down anyhow. But the women who had been working in men's jobs were just quietly told, well, that's it. Thank you very much. And that included women who'd been working for the first time as clerks in the public service. Because before that, women were not employed as clerks. They were employed as typists, or as stenographers, if you remember those. Remember the secretaries, you know, those wonderful, wonderful beings who did everything. And they were employed in those positions, and they were positions which were capped, and so the women could never be promoted out of them, or very rarely. So the women who'd been working as bank tellers, for example, were quietly told, well, sorry, that's it. You can be secretaries in the bank, but you can't be bank tellers anymore. You need to go home and have babies. Yes. And there was a very concerted move in the late 1940s and 1950s to encourage women to go back into the home and to make their careers as mothers and homemakers. And by and large, that's what most of them did.
Yes, it's interesting, Margaret, because of course, I guess the kernel to the seeds were planted for what actually became a movement through the 60s, I guess, where it flourished. But at least, and let's be honest about this, equal pay, etc., is still an issue for women all these years later. And it's a bit of a sad fact. But the point being, this exhibition you have on at the Old Treasury Building in Spring Street, Melbourne, well worth a visit. Women Work for Victory in World War II, it gives some history and understanding to what was actually happening behind the scenes, away from the front line, back home, and with women engaged in a whole lot of great work, and understandably reluctant to give that up when the war ended. You've also
That's
got,
right.
you've got some great exhibitions on there too, Margaret. What about A Nation Divided, the Great War and Conscription? What's happening there?
Ah, now that's an exhibition that we've had up for a very long time, and it too, sadly, will be coming out. It's due to be replaced with another exhibition around about January. Now, what I should say, in case anybody thinks, oh no, we're always using that, because it's used a lot by schools, as you can imagine, both of
Yes,
those
schools.
exhibitions are.
Yes.
Don't despair, because absolutely everything, plus more information, will stay on the website. In the last few years, we've developed a practice that when we open an exhibition, we put not only the exhibition itself, the content up, but we add expanded material because, as you can probably imagine, Greg, when we research exhibitions, we can only put a tiny fraction. In the bit, and sometimes I think, you know, we're historians, we get a bit carried away. There's probably too many words anyway. So we put all of that content up and that will stay. But The Nation Divided is been an interesting one, and particularly in the context of recent attempts to amend the Constitution, because essentially, the story of that is that Billy Hughes wanted to introduce conscription in World War I, and would have been able to do it as other nations did, just by legislation. He didn't have to amend the constitution to do it. There was a bit of a ban in terms of the armed services, of sending the armed services overseas to serve. They had to be volunteers. Now, the reason Billy Hughes went to referenda was because he knew that by that stage he didn't have a majority in Parliament. His own party would oppose him. He was a Labour Prime Minister at the start of the war.
That's right. Yes.
And he knew that his party would oppose him. So he knew he couldn't get it through by legislation, and he tried to force it through, driving on what he rightly judged to be enthusiasm for the war. Now, the interesting thing about that is that the Australian people did, as we all know, support the war, both wars, amazingly generously in with their lives, with their labour. But there was a sense that people who were sent to fight and to die should do so voluntarily and not be forced.
Yes.
And in the end, that prevailed, as you probably know. So he had another go in 1917, by which time the voluntary numbers were falling off, not surprisingly, because the scale of the losses was just so horrendous. And people were sickened by what they were reading about, not only Gallipoli, but the war on the Western Front, Palestine, all of those dreadful losses. And so Hughes, by this time, no longer a Labour Prime Minister, but leading a sort of a coalition government, had another crack at the referendum and lost again. And that's the interesting thing, isn't it? That thereafter, the next time that the issue of conscription came up, during Vietnam, there was no attempt at a referendum. It was simply put through as a ballot, as we all know, with hugely controversial consequences that time around too.
Indeed, indeed, Margaret. And of course, from the old Treasury building, we're speaking to Margaret Anderson, Director. When you speak about Vietnam, of course, the governments had learned of the failure of Billy Hughes to get the referendum passed and weren't going to go down that track again. And of course, what eventuated there, as we well know, was one of the greatest, I guess, protest movements seen in Australia up until that stage to end the war and, of course, end conscription, which was a very divisive part of Australia's history. And of course, these exhibitions, they're an integral part not only of Melbourne, Victoria, but of all Australia. And when we look at, I guess, women working for victory, that happened all around Australia. And of course, the Great War and a nation divided with conscription, or the discussion of conscription, again, that's an Australia-wide thing. So I commend the old Treasury building on their scope of coverage of matters. You have got something though there on the Yarra River.
Well, we certainly do. One of the themes that we try and reflect in the museum, Greg, is the history of Melbourne. Along with, we have three themes, I guess. Gold, the history of Melbourne and the urban areas around it, and government and the process of government, because our building housed the governor, and still does house the office of the governor, and meetings of executive council take place in the building. So executive government has been a part of our building since 1862, which is pretty extraordinary.
Wow.
But in the process of that, we do reflect on the history of the Yarra, and that is an area where we've tried to reflect also on First Nations history in some detail, and on the whole process of dispossession, focusing on the river, which of course was one of the hugely important sustaining ecosystems that supported First Nations
Indeed, indeed, indeed,
and
Margaret. And
yes, and
it's
occupation.
this is where the exhibitions at the old Treasury building are so important. And you spoke, of course, earlier about being a great resource for schools, and it's important that schools learn this history.
Terribly important. And I guess one of the things that we're all dealing with now is the aftermath of the latest attempt to amend the Constitution, and where we go from there in terms of reconciling with First
Yes,
Nations
yes.
people. And we feel that we, in particular in our building, need to reflect on this history because for quite a long time, you know that it was an administrative building of government for many, many years. It was partly why it was built, that and to store gold during the gold rush. But it did house the Aboriginal Protection, so-called Aboriginal Protection Board, for many, many years. And so the Old Treasury Building is itself an integral part of the colonial history of Victoria and First Nations people. So we feel it's especially important for us, I suppose, to reflect on that history.
Yes, well, look, so happy to be involved in partnership with you in spreading the word and obviously the history, not only once again of Victoria, but of Australia in regards to the First Nations people. Which was unfortunately turned into a political discussion when it shouldn't have been. But that's another matter. You've got belongings, objects, and family life. You've got Protest Melbourne, which is a unique thing. We spoke about Vietnam. What's the Protest Melbourne? What do you look at there?
Just about every area of protest. Now that's not quite true, of course, but we look at the long history of protest. So we look at actually First Nations protest, which began in the 19th century,
Wow.
with Barak as the great leader leading a deputation when there was a plan to close Corranderk, the mission. But we do certainly look at the protest movements of the 1960s and 70s. And so the moratorium movement, the women's movement, women's liberation, finally, the gay rights movement, as it was then called in the 1970s. And we look at the various anti-war and environment movements too. So we sort of finish with the environment movement, but the interesting thing too, I think, about the history of protest is the way in which it changed in the last few years, and
Right.
particularly during COVID.
Yes.
Because the protest movements up until that point had often tended to be radical movements, as in radical political movements, not exclusively, but probably the majority. Now, the big change that happened during COVID was that we saw the backlash to COVID, didn't we, and to the restrictions.
Indeed.
And so we reflect a little bit on the way in which the nature of protest changed. And we asked a couple of questions at the end, too, about whether our own attitudes to protest changed at all during COVID.
Such an interesting question.
I think they did for a time.
Yes.
People felt, well, yes, protest is important, but not now.
Yes.
Now, interestingly enough, the most recent protest that took place, we haven't attempted to do anything about this, of course. I was intrigued by the fact that the radio was interviewing various people who were caught in the traffic, and asking them what they thought, probably expecting that people would say, oh, you know, it's a jolly nuisance, and I've been stuck here for an hour. But in fact, what the person who was interviewed said, well, yes, it's inconvenient, but it's important that they've got the right to protest, isn't it? And I
Yeah.
thought, well, now, isn't that interesting? Their protest movements, I suppose, really sit at the heart of our democracy in a sense, don't
Well,
they?
it's actually something, Margaret, that the Last Post magazine has been at the forefront of since we started in 2011. And yes, and it's a good point that you raise because, of course, we mustn't forget that. And I guess the one great thing that we have is democracy. And then we look at the offshoots of democracy. We have the ability to protest, and that remains one of the most important fundamentals of life in a democracy.
It does indeed. And that was the interesting thing because, of course, it's a limited right. I mean, in Victoria, we actually do have some legislation which underpins the right to protest. It's, you know, the right to gather in a public place, the right to express an opinion. That is not the case in other states outside the ACT, incidentally. And it's not the case in Australia as a whole because we don't have anything like a Bill of Rights that other countries do. But here we do. Nevertheless, it is hemmed in around the fact that the right to protest can be suspended during a national emergency.
With that right to protest in Victoria, does Victoria actually lead the way in regards to that?
I think it was actually the ACT. that passed the legislation first. I'd
Right.
have to go back and have a look, but I think the ACT might have enacted something first. And then Victoria passed the, now was it 2006, the rights and responsibilities, the Act to establish rights and responsibilities. I think it's linked rights and responsibilities, so
It's
it's
incredible
an
stuff.
interesting pairing of the two.
Well,
So
yeah, you know what?
it's not an open slab, in other words.
When I visit the old Treasury building, Margaret, Margaret Anderson, director of the old Treasury building in Spring Street, Melbourne, we're speaking with, it makes me want to go back to school again because there's so much there in the history, and I was always a history buff at school, and I just love it.
Oh, Greg, you're very kind. Thank you. Well, you
That's a
must come and see our latest exhibition, which is after the very serious things we've been talking about. This is a little bit of fun, I suppose.
Yes.
It's called Belongings, Objects and Family Life.
Oh,
And
yes.
it looks at the role that objects, things, have in our lives and have had in our lives. But specifically, it's asking what sort of objects have shaped the Australian family over time. And so we look at a whole lot of things, including the family home, not physically, of course, but we've got a little model. We have a wedding dress. We have, of all things, we have a camera, we have a telephone, an early telephone, and a mobile phone. But we also have things like an indoor toilet. We have the pill, and all sorts of different things. So it's a great fun exhibition. And at the end of it, we ask people just to drop us a little note about the things that are most important in their lives. And it's been just quite fascinating seeing what sort of things people pick out.
How wonderful. How wonderful the interaction of people that go along to the old Treasury building to see all your wonderful exhibitions plus Belongings, Objects and Family Life, which I've got to get along to see, Margaret. So thanks very much for telling us about that. And once again, it's an important thing. And this is where schools and historians can benefit greatly by popping in and seeing you there. It's free entry. You've got public tours and private tours. And you can go to the shop and buy some things. So, I mean, it's a fantastic day to spend there.
Thank you, Greg. And we're open every day except Saturday.
Every day
So we
except
say
Saturday. Thank you
Sunday
so
to
much.
Friday. Thank
Thank
you.
you so much, Margaret Anderson, Director of the Old Treasury Building there in Melbourne, a museum that reflects the history not only of Victoria and Melbourne, but also in many instances, Greater Australia. So get along there and see it. You're listening to the great, well, it is the great, you're listening to the last post radio show podcast series with Greg Ross. More soon.